cooking in oil and stuff like that. Yeah, you can use the little carbon resistors, but you've got a way of dissipating the heat. He's going to have to work that out. I like the idea of the coaxial cables, and he would be able to wind them up in 10-foot sections and be able to attenuate that way and still use a rotary switch to select the cables. So, yeah, that's a workaround as far as I think that would be a good idea for him.
Yeah, lots of VH guys have done that. And there are ways you can choose cable that has very high internal insertion loss. For instance, the semi-rigid cables, if you had access to those, they're a little bit exotic, but the semi-rigid cables made by the Uniform Tubes Company way back in the old days, they were sold to some other company. You'll eventually find out who it is. They make cable that is a 0.141 diameter, 0.141 inch, 0.085, 0.047. As you go to the smaller and smaller diameter cables, the insertion loss per foot goes up pretty fast, but since they are a Teflon internal cable with a metal sheath on the outside, heat sinking the cable so that the power is dissipating does not create overheating of the cable is pretty easy. There are guys who have taken pieces of semi-rigid cable where maybe the particular cable is rated for 10 watts max, and they put 100 watts through the cable by simply soldering the cable down to a metal sheath, a piece of copper, so that everywhere along the length of the cable, it has a heat sink connected to the outer conductor, and therefore you can dissipate a hell of a lot more power. The power rating of these cables, in many cases, is the worst case situation when the cable is inside of a conduit or it's in a confined area where it doesn't have a clearly defined convective airflow or a local heat sink. So a semi-rigid cable, you could even do it, let me think. You could probably even do it with flexible cable, small diameter flexible cable. You could put a lot more power into it by taking off the outer insulated layer so that the braid is available to you, and solder the braid down to a copper sheet would allow you to get a lot more heat dissipation in the cable, and so that a small length of cable, small diameter, could dissipate a lot more power than normally once you realize how the heat sinking is going on. You'd have to choose Teflon cable to do that, which would be easier to solder. I'll admit that flexible braided cable that has a polyethylene dielectric inside, you're not going to be able to solder that unless you're very skilled, because you'd be melting the polyethylene while you're trying to do the soldering, unless you use low-temperature solder. Well, the low-temperature solder has got its own problems. It's got exotic fluxes that are an acetic solution. You'd have to do a real good job of washing it away at the end of the soldering operation to be sure you didn't have a corrosion forming downrange. But there's a lot of solutions to this. I mean, we all are seeking transmission lines that intentionally have very low loss. There's an amazing number of situations where you want to use a transmission line that's got a whole lot of loss as an attenuator. And it can be a very precise attenuator with one slight catch. Let me drop. And that is, in the past, when I was testing a 300-watt or a kilowatt transmitter, and I chose a particular length of line to act as an attenuator because the particular power meter I used didn't go to 300 watts or 100 watts. Maybe the power meter I was using only went to 50 watts. So my 300-watt transmitter had to be attenuated down to 50 watts in order to make the measurement. And I chose a certain length of RG8 cable to do that. I soon discovered that as you press down the key and you watch the power meter, you'll watch the power slowly fade by about 10%, because as RG8 cable heats up, the insertion loss of the cable slightly increased. So you got to be careful to make the measurement fast enough, so to speak, before the cable gets hot. Or you can calibrate the cable. There's ways you can measure the insertion loss of the cable when it's hot versus cold and find out what's really going on. But there's that one disadvantage of using a coaxial cable as an attenuator. It will have a little bit of fade characteristic as it heats up if you're not doing a good job of heat sinking the cable. But these are minor perturbations, and for these guys with a good scientific mind, I know they'll find a workaround on that one. So if you think if we answer that one, go to the next one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, those are some good answers for him. What I've done, I had some SMA cable connectors on some very thin coax, and the way I did the heat sinking was I had three of those independent loops. I sandwich them between two pieces of 1/8 aluminum with heat sink compound. I just made a little sandwich, squished it down, bolted it together, and it really did a good job, and it works as well as a heat sink on a transistor. So that's one, another way you could go. If you're ready for the next one, I'll go ahead.
I just thought of something here, John. There is another approach that we should mention. By the way, if you want 10 watts out instead of 25 watts, that is an insertion loss of almost exactly 4 dB, 3.998 to be exact. Let's call it 4 dB. You want 4 dB of insertion loss. Another method of getting 4 dB insertion loss would be to use a directional coupler. If you had a directional coupler of 4 dB of coupling coefficient, the straight-through line from your transmitter would go into a 25-watt approximately dummy load. Now the directional coupler output port that's 4 dB down would be giving you 10 watts of output. Or if you chose a 14 dB directional coupler, you'd be getting 1 watt of output, 25 watts going through. So a directional coupler acting as a power sampler, where the main straight-through line of the directional coupler goes into a dummy load, that's another very nice approach. To find a 25-watt dummy load or a 50-watt dummy load is easy on the surplus market. To find resistors that are low in reactance but can dissipate 25 watts, that's kind of hard. The coaxial cable approach is a way, as long as you're willing to put the length of cable coiled up in there and heat sink the cable. But the directional coupler requires no heat sink. The dummy load is the heat sink. The directional coupler, and by the way, home brewing a 4 dB directional coupler at 2 meters, that is a rather easy project for a guy that's a little bit skilled, with hand tools, to make a triplate strip line or a microstrip strip line, 4 decibel directional coupler. Good science project. The price of the materials required to do it are not high. The amount of hand tool skill required to do it is not high. So designing your own directional coupler, buying a 4 dB directional coupler is a little bit difficult. Directional couplers tend to come in numbers like 3 dB, 6 dB, 10 dB, 20 dB. 3, 6, 10, 20 are the popular numbers for the coupling coefficient for a directional coupler. To find one at 4 dB is a little bit difficult. There's another way around that one even. Your directional coupler, which is made for a higher frequency region, or a lower frequency, a higher frequency region, will give you, let me think now, a smaller amount of signal, and that's not the right direction. Yeah. If you bought a 3 dB directional coupler that's made for a higher frequency than your frequency, if you bought one that's made for 432 and you're using it at 2 meters, the coupled line would give you less signal output, and so would it give you 4 down to 3, 3 down to 4? Maybe not. But looks to me like home brewing is an approach. So, directional coupling, attenuating with resistors, attenuating with cables. Those are the three main approaches I can think of. There's probably a way of doing it with two horns aimed at each other, but I'm not going to go there. KC2WGB, K2RW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we won't go with the horns, that's for sure. It looks from his letter that he wants to go in approximately 2-watt steps. So maybe he could do that with several lengths of coax. I think that would probably be the quickest and cheapest for him. But if you're ready, I'll go on to the next one.
Fire when ready, John.
Well, this description I know you're familiar with, working with HP generators. I have a letter from an email here from Ham, and he wants to know, what is a backward wave oscillator? Give him a description on that one, Dick.
Now, that is a Klystrom-like vacuum tube, popular, back in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. For instance, the very first Hewlett-Packard major spectrum analyzer that came out with in roughly 1965 did have a swept frequency variable voltage-controlled oscillator inside that was a backward wave oscillator, a BWO, they call it, BWO. It is a Klystron-like device where ordinarily the slow wave structure inside, you put a signal into the input of the slow wave structure, which could be a helix. The output of the helix has the signal that's 20, 30, 40 dB stronger, and that is your transmitter. Well, by not using the output connector on the slow wave structure, by terminating that with a short circuit or an open circuit, the signal internally of the distributed, the slow wave structure vacuum tube amplifier with magnetics on it, the signal flows backwards, gets back to the input, starts the oscillation all over again, and so by changing the control voltage on that helix, you change the velocity of propagation, you therefore change the frequency. So these backward wave oscillators, as I said, it was a magnetic structure. They tended to be a little bit on the beefy side, you know, a quarter of a cubic foot. They tended to be a couple of pounds. They ran on a couple thousand volts. And by sweeping the voltage on the control port, you could make them sweep at least an octave. A backward wave oscillator that would sweep from 2 to 4 gigahertz was easy in the old days. Nowadays, a varactive diode-type solid-state oscillator, voltage-controlled oscillator, VCO, is a much nicer technique, a much smaller, cheaper, more efficient structure. Doesn't require all of these vacuum tubes.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So a modern-day voltage-controlled oscillator, solid-state circuit tuned with a varactor diode, is smaller, cheaper, faster, lighter, and a lot more popular. So backward-wave oscillators have a historic reason for existence these days. In other words, people want to know something about how distributed amplifying structures, a traveling wave tube and a klystron amplifier, are devices that have a slow-wave structure in time. They have a velocity modulator function, which gives you the gain function in them. And so they've got all kinds of magnetic focusing and high voltages and whatever. They're very unpopular these days. You might find a classic old spectrum analyzer or a signal generator that has one, but as I said, they're falling away real fast because nobody is maintaining them. If you wanted to buy that particular part, if your particular signal generator or spectrum analyzer contained a BWO and that particular component failed and you wanted to replace that component today, you could probably have a pretty difficult time trying to find one of those. You'd have to find somebody who is willing to cannibalize the one that he owns, because I think essentially nobody is manufacturing them for the normal UHF, SHF frequencies. There may be a backward wave oscillator that's still available today if you wanted a voltage-controlled oscillator running at 90 gigahertz. There may be some manufacturer out there building that today. But for the normal UHF, SHF frequencies, I think it is an obsolete, pretty rare animal today, John. KC2 WGB, and I've used a few of these, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. That gives them a good description of what it is and use. In fact, I own two HP generators that have the BWOs in them, and I have a few, and they're exchangeable. The only thing I don't understand, which I'm sure you run into, when you have to replace it or change frequency, it's only replaceable from the rear. It's not a front plug-in module. What a horror that is. Have you run into that experience?
Yeah, the B-Row is such a big, bulky thing with its magnetics, with its high-voltage power supply, with its fancy control circuitry for the voltage variable frequency control circuit and so on. It's a real big deal, and the fact that it's not a plug-in from the front panel doesn't surprise me. My guess is the particular HP, if it happens to be HP signal generator you own that contains a B-Row, my guess is it's a 1960 or 1970 vintage signal generator. You might tell me what model number it is. I'm going to guess it might be something like a Hewlett-Packard 612, 614, one of those very old, moosey, great big signal generators. Is that approximately what it is, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I believe the model number is an 8591, and they're about, let's see, I would say late 70s or early 80s, and extremely heavy. Oh, these things are monsters. And I have two of them, and I'm looking to replace them because these are used in high frequency. One goes from 2 gig to 7 gig. The other one goes up to, I think, 21 gig. But they're nice instruments, but very bulky, very big compared to the new things today. Great stuff.
And if that tube ever failed on you, hopefully it won't, they had reasonably good reliability, but if that tube ever failed on you and you had to replace it, I think you'd go through a devil of a job trying to find somebody that will sell you that tube at a reasonable price. You'd have to find somebody who's willing to cannibalize an older piece of equipment. I think there's a high probability that nobody is manufacturing that particular device anymore. Not even your foreign tube manufacturers like Svetlana are going to manufacture that, because the solid-state, modern-day equivalent for that oscillator is so much smaller, cheaper, lighter, faster, that any manufacturer building oscillators are going to build the new one and not bother building the old one anymore. I think it's almost a lost art. I wonder, are you a little bit worried about what would happen if you had to replace that oscillator, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, it's getting to the point the next failure I have, I will buy a new instrument and replace both of them with one single instrument. Some of the Wiltrons and things like that are much better and much faster operations, too. I had to replace one of the BWOs last year, and used, it cost me $600 just for that sliding module.
And you probably could buy, I'm guessing that your BWO put out, let me pick a number, 30 milliwatts or something like that in power. And to buy a 30 milliwatt voltage-controlled oscillator, solid-state equivalent, that could be a, it wouldn't be form, fit, and function replacement, but it would be something that functionally is the right thing. My guess is you could buy that VCO these days for a small fraction of that $600. How about you, John?
You're right, Dick. More like $200 for an entire unit with more of a range than these have. So, absolutely right. Ready for the next one, sir?
You've got it, John. Go ahead.
Okay. Have an email questioning noise control, and he's questioning two different systems. One is called a noise blanker, and one is a noise inverter. Could you describe how they're used and what the difference and the purposes? That's it from here.
Yeah, when it comes to noise blankers, there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. The top of the line, in my opinion, is the noise blanker that was built into the Drake R4C receiver. That receiver was all 1985 vintage. I own one of those. It's a tube-type receiver. But is it tube-type? No, it's got a couple of tubes and most of it's solid-state, but it's got a solid-state noise blanker with some FET transistors in the IF strip. As I may have told you guys before, when the Montauk Point radar was really blasting way back in the late 80s, it was a multi-gigawatt transmitter, 135-foot dish. It really had a fierce amount of energy that it transmitted in the 432 megacycle ham radio region. And when that radar, which is 70 miles from my house out on the east end of Long Island on the South Fork, when it was running, that antenna, when it aimed at me as it swept by once every 12 seconds, gave me a signal 120 decibels above my threshold. I could disconnect the coaxial cable coming from my antenna down to the shack into the 432 receiver. I could disconnect that cable, and I would hear the main bang coming out of the receiver. It crawled through the power supply wiring 70 miles away, below the tree line, above, around the Earth curvature and everything else. That was a potent radar. And when that radar was on the air, and I tried to listen to anybody on the 432 band, if it wasn't a guy running a kilowatt 1 mile away from me, I wouldn't hear him. That radar dominated. Let me drop. Because the radar was putting out something like 350 pulses per second, as you tuned across the band, every 350 hertz, you would hear another one of its spectral side lobes. The sine X over X individual spectral side lobes are all 330 kc apart, in my example. So as you tuned across the band, you would hear Q, 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 Q. Each one of these individual tones with your sideband receiver, you'd be tuning across. And it blanked many megacycles of the band got wiped out simultaneously when that radar was on the air. Turn on, and my 432 converter converted from 432 megacycles down to 28 megacycles, and I'm using the Drake R4C receiver with its built-in blanker option, a plug-in module that you plugged inside the cabinet. I would tune that across the 28 megacycle band, and that was really tuning across the 432 megacycle band because of the transmitting and receiving converter I'm using. I turned on that blanker. The radar completely disappeared. I heard almost nothing from the radar when my antenna was aimed directly at it. So with my antenna aimed down the throat of that radar, when the main band came past me, I could just barely hear that something was there. A weak signal in the back lobe of my antenna when I'm aimed to the east of the radar, and as a weak guy on 432 in New Jersey on the back lobe, I could easily copy his Morse code when that blanker was operating. So did that blanker have capability? A very inexpensive noise blanker recognizes the fact that when a strong signal comes along, you get a leading edge spike that comes through the receiver. By putting a diode limiter circuit in the audio, you can eliminate some of that energy and do a kind of blanking. That's a poor man's blanker. However, what's happening in that case is that you're getting a potent signal coming in the front end. It goes roaring down the IF strip and rings your IF strip like a bell. You know what happens when you hit a bell. It rings for a while. But you put a strong enough pulse into the IF strip of your receiver, and your IF strip might...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The IF strip of your receiver may have something like 15 kilohertz of bandwidth, and so that very strong pulse starts ringing your IF strip at a 15 kilohertz rate, and it takes some number of milliseconds for that ring to ring down. And by the time it rings down, the next pulse from the radar is there and ringing it back up again. So there was never any dead time, if you know what I mean, with any reasonable bandwidth of IF strip of the receiver. That's what happens when a real strong signal comes along. The way this noise blanker worked is that right after the RF amplifier, it had a sensitive detecting circuit that saw the leading edge of the strong pulse coming down into the receiver. The RF front end of the receiver had something more like 10 megacycles of bandwidth, so it would ring down in a small number of microseconds. So there was a leading edge detector that recognized the leading edge of a strong pulse coming into the receiver. There was a delay line between the RF front end and the noise blanker in the IF strip. So in other words, let me make a guess that the delay line had 10 microseconds of delay. So 10 microseconds later, the pulse was going to arrive at the IF strip of the receiver. But the detector up front had a leading edge. It had a priori knowledge by 10 microseconds. So the detector saw the strong leading edge of the pulse. It gave a blanking pulse to the blanking circuit. At the front end of the IF strip was an on-off switch, a field effect diode, a field effect transistor switch that had an on-off ratio of about 100 dB. So 100 decibels of electronic attenuation at the right number of microseconds was turned on in front of the IF strip, so that the IF strip never saw the strong pulse, never got the chance to do ringing. When the pulse went away, detected by the front end detector, it turned the switch back on, and so now the net result was the radar was transmitting, let me pick a number, a 5 mic The radar was transmitting a 5 microsecond pulse every 3 milliseconds, so it's got a duty factor of a small fraction of 1%. And your noise blanker with this proper circuit design is blanking the receiver 0.1% of the time. 99.9% of the time, the receiver is completely operational during the dead times when the radar is not giving me a pulse, and no ringing of the fine-tuned circuit of the IF strip took place. I studied that blanker to try to find out how in the world did they get that much performance. It was very well designed by the Drake Company in Miamisburg, Ohio. I can't remember the engineer's name, but he did a very good job on that particular noise blanker. It turns out the Kenwood 520 receiver has a noise blanker that's almost as good, not quite as good. And a few of the other receivers have a noise blanker almost as good. But that particular noise blanker would take out very strong radars. It would take out a certain amount of 60-cycle spiking noise from an arcing transformer. A well-tuned noise blanker, well-designed noise blanker, can eliminate an awful lot of impulse noise from ignitions, of automobiles, for instance, and create almost no distortion in the audio. And when the noise blanker is on and operating, you think you've got normal operation in a quiet environment. So, as you can tell, there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. Some of them are nowhere near that good, but it does require some fancy circuitry. Now, one of the things that Mel K2KNB, Mel Schneider, was experimenting with for quite a number of years is a noise inverter. Let me drop. What he was doing was running the equivalent of two separate receivers. His main receiver was listening to the signal that he cared for. The second receiver was tuned a little bit higher or a little bit lower in frequency, and it was looking for local impulse noise. The receiver was tuned in such a way that only impulse signals above a certain threshold would be picked up by that receiver. He carefully coupled the output of the second receiver into the circuitry of the first receiver, where the amplitude of the impulse was properly adjusted in amplitude and opposite in phase, and therefore he was doing noise inverting type of cancellation. By a separate receiver tuned to an adjacent frequency, he was picking up the impulse noise, setting the amplitude correctly, and inverting it in voltage, making it the opposite voltage, injecting into the receiver, and that will give you noise cancellation. You're not going to get 100 decibels of attenuation by that technique, but 20 decibels, maybe even 30 decibels of noise suppression by a noise inverter carefully tuned is possible. There's a couple of catches. If on an adjacent channel that he tuned to, another strong ham radio signal came along, it could disturb the operation of the circuitry, in which case he'd have to retune it a little bit to get away from the strong signal. But noise inverting is one approach that has been used on HF receivers. It's not quite as good as noise blanking, in my opinion. Each has its advantages. So when it comes to the noise blanking techniques, some of the best ones invented in the world were done by the United Kingdom. Let me drop. For a whole lot of years, over-the-air broadcast television in the United Kingdom had the normal amplitude-modulated video, and the audio was also amplitude-modulated, not FM-modulated, like our NTSC, our National Television Selection Committee for the United States, selected FM for the audio, 4.5 megs away from the video. That was our television broadcast. So because we had a limiter in our FM receiver audio portion of our television set, we didn't have anywhere near as much impulse noise as the Brits did. The Brits, because they chose a standard with amplitude-modulated audio, local ignition noise from arcing a heater in a fish tank, or television, or lawnmowers and automobiles gave them a lot of grief. So they did a lot of design of various kinds of noise blankers, noise inverters, noise blankers, and whatever. So way back 20 or so years ago, some of the best noise blanking techniques were also being experimented with and developed by the Brits. I think that modern day television no longer has amplitude modulation. Everything has gone digital, so that kind of development is no longer going on anywhere near as much. That gives you a thumbnail sketch of noise blanking and noise inverting. KC2 WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, I think Joe has a good description now, Dick, of exactly what it does. And in fact, you're right. In this country, in the early TV days, every time a car would drive by with ignition noise, the set would roll. So what they did was exactly what you said. They had developed a noise blanker that would pick that up for that split second and just float the sync, and you would not have the problem anymore. Quite a few manufacturers developed that system, and it worked very well. So, okay. Well, from Mel's Corner, that's about it. And back to you, Dick.
The very early 1947 RCA 630 television set, very popular between 1947 and 1950 or so, the RCA 630, had symbol-derived automatic gain control, so that when an airplane flew by, when an automobile drove in front of your car with ignition noise, the television set would roll and do all kinds of nasty things. In the early 1950s, they created something called keyed AGC. In other words, rather than have a wide-open automatic gain control on the television set, they had a circuit that looked for the amplitude of the television signal, and it opened up a gate only during the time that either the horizontal or vertical sync pulse was taking place. I'm not sure which. It could have been either the horizontal or the vertical. I'm going to guess it was the horizontal. During the retrace time of the television set, when the horizontal sync pulse, the strongest portion of the transmission, was taking place, a gate was opened for a couple of microseconds, an amplitude measurement was made, and that amplitude measurement was only made for, let's say, 1% of the time. 99% of the time, the automatic gain control circuit was no longer active because the gate was closed. Because to measure the gain of the signal during the time the video is going up and down, which is an amplitude modulated signal, doesn't give you useful information. It was only the peaks of the sync pulses that really you wanted to measure, so they opened a gate at that time. That was called the keyed AGC. I would call it gated AGC. The gated AGC, because its percentage of time it was active was like 1% as opposed to 100%, the old circuit. Now, you could say 99% of the grief created by ignition static and airplanes flying by and whatever, an awful lot of that grief disappeared once the modern-day television set went over to the sampled or gated AGC system. So that was another part of why later television set...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's another reason why more modern-day television sets acted so much better. You'd be amazed how many circuits in the military world and the commercial world have gated circuits that open up a switch for a short period of time when the useful information is coming by and close during the rest of the time, which drastically lowers vulnerability. There's a lot of military and commercial circuits that do that. So it's another concept to put in the back of your mind when you're doing a circuit design. Paul? What has National Aeronautics and Space Administration been doing lately? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Yeah, this is WS2N. Well, the couple of things, but they did have a launch on Friday. And Atlas V went up. That's one of the big ones for our unmanned spacecraft out of Cape Canaveral. And they launched military satellite by the Navy, MUOS, they call it, the Mobile User Objective System number one. There's going to be a two, a three, and a four, and eventually a five. And these things are put in geosynchronous orbit. And what these are going to do is replace the old constellation system that the military is using now. It's going to be about 10 times more effective, higher frequencies, more frequencies involved. Let me drop it. Really, it's supposed to be their idea of UHF 300 megahertz to 3 gigahertz. And really what they do, you know, out in the military world, it's not like living near a city where you've got cell phone towers all over everywhere. These things replace that. And being up in geosynchronous orbit with these gigantic antennas coming off of this thing, you can operate an average of 1 watt. If you're in a poor location, maybe up to 7 watts. And you could run your voice, data, video. It's all for SATCOM, you know, really a military setup. So eventually they'll have more of these things up there to work together. More will work at, you know, doing everything around the whole globe. There will be a fifth one, and really that's going to be a backup. So nice flight sort of thing on a computer, take off from Florida. And it's looks like a big unit. I mean, it's went off on an Atlas 551. That means the first five, that stands for the diameter, 5 meters. So here's this thing, 5 meter in diameter, the cone that you see at the top there. Fairing is 5 meters in diameter, so it's a big unit, and it needed plenty of power to be put into geosynchronous orbit. But it's got an interesting antenna, this big mesh parabolic antenna that comes out of this thing. It's got to be 40 feet diameter. I don't know. I tried to find out, but looked at the picture. But you know, you've got the satellite with the big solar panel sticking out of it, and here's this big linkage
repeater, timeout. Repeater, Timeout. Cancel.
Peter, time that. What did I lose, Dick?
You only lost the last 10 seconds. Go ahead, Paul.
Understood. I thought I'd bring up of that launch, the MUOS. And we'll watch more of these things go up in the future. I thought I'd bring that up. As long as I've got it, I wanted to bring up, probably didn't get through last week, about Janet Voss, astronaut, woman astronaut in the early 1990s. She started flying on the shuttle, flew five flights, and she passed away. So I thought I'd bring that up. You hear all these other people in the entertainment world that die or whatever, and you don't hear much about some of these people. But I think I've done a lot. She was one of the first people who actually did the first Sky Hab mission, where we used to put the big room in the back of the cargo bay, really is what it was, of the space shuttle. And they used to float to the back, you know, from the front of the shuttle to the back, and they used to spend all their time there. This is before the space station, even before Mir. And eventually, she was on one of the flights that did go to Mir. And also, let me drop it. This is WS2N. John Glenn, 50-year anniversary was last Monday as well. I mentioned that last week, too, but here it is 50 years later. He's like 90 years old now, and I know we talked about it last week. He did finally go up. You asked about it, Dick, when he was like 72 years old, 72, 73 years old. He became the oldest astronaut to have a fly. So there you go. One other thing, not space-related, but physics-related, is that the Large Hadron Collider, that neutrino deal with, you know, going the fast, you know, faster than the speed of light, looks like it might be a foul-up from what I saw on the Internet. Bad cables or bad connectors or something. It was apparently giving false readings. I think they're going to run these tests eventually again. So I'd like to see what happens. You might remember they said that these neutrinos were going through the Earth and popping out a little too fast. It looked like they were going faster than the speed of light. It looks like right now it's probably not true. But we'll have to see. Let me drop it. WS2N. Okay, that's pretty much all I wanted to bring up. And maybe a question later in the later part of the net, Dick, when you really get involved. Back to you. WS2N.
Okay, sounds like you've got a technical question. We'll put you on the list. In the case of the MUOS satellite, you made a rough estimate that the parabolic dish, which is all folded up and it unfolds in space, is in the vicinity of 40 feet in diameter. And I think you said that the satellite is going to be giving communications, military communications, between 300 megs and 3 gigs. A 40-foot diameter dish at 300 megs gives a gain of 29 dB over isotropic. At 3 gigs, it gives a gain of 49 dB. At 300 megacycles, where the gain is 29 dB, it's got a beam width of 6.3 degrees. At 3 gigs, it's going to have a beam width of 6-tenths of a degree. The Earth, when you're in synchronous orbit, and you look back to the Earth 22,300 miles away, the Earth is around an 18-degree diameter device. The Earth that the satellite is flying above. Let me drop. So where the beam width on that dish is somewhere between 6 degrees and 6-tenths of a degree, they can decide where to aim it, and maybe it's got multiple feed horns. And you could set it up in such a case where one feed horn favors North America, another feed horn favors Europe, so to speak, on that kind of a...
antenna deck.
Go ahead, that again, Paul.
There's a lot more to this antenna. If you look at the design of it, it's true, it's parabolic antenna, but incorporated in this thing, it looks like about 50 dipoles, 50. Don't understand the hookup, but I don't know if they're all connected in phase or what the deal is. So it's got a depth to it, a thickness to this thing, and inside this incorporate all this. I don't know if it has to do with the multiple frequencies, you know, going from, you know, from 30 all the way up to, you know, it was a 3 gig range. I don't get it. Maybe you're familiar with that, but if you bring it up eventually on, I'm not sure which site. I looked at so many sites. But one of them has pictures of this dish, and you'd have to bring up the satellite name, and you could eventually find it. But the MUOS satellite, it's more than just this made it seem like it's just a big round dish up there. There's more to it than that.
Were the 50 dipoles on a great big curved surface located at approximately the focal point of the parabolic dish, or were the dipoles just in front of the surface? If it was a focal plane array, in other words, a whole bunch of dipoles of various lengths mounted on a hyperbolic surface at the focal point, that would be what an antenna engineer would call a cluster feed. In other words, a kind of a phased array feed where you can electronically steer the beam by determining which of those dipoles are active, what amplitude and phase is coming out of those each dipoles. That steers the primary pattern from that feed horn assembly, which then steers the signal into the parabolic dish, which focuses into a nice sharp beam that you aim at various places on the earth. So were all those dipoles mounted out in front of the dish at approximately the focal point of the dish? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Looks like the back is parabolic, and then it's got this thickness to it in front of it. So I guess it's in front of it. But I mean, you know, the focal point would have to change all the time. I don't get it. I tried to look into it deeper, but maybe because this is a military satellite, you know, they're just showing it, you know, an overview of what it looks like. Very hard to get any real, you know, I mean, any information about it. I tried to find out the power on the solar panels, and, you know, things that you normally could find on all these satellites, maybe because the military is hard to find.
One of the words you just used, Paul, represents a bit of a misunderstanding. A parabolic dish has a focal point, which is geometry, not a function of frequency or wavelength. If you're using a parabolic dish at 300 megacycles up to 3 gigs, the focal point is one point in space at every one of those frequencies. When you steer the beam by moving the place where you're putting the feed horn, so to speak, if I move the feed horn a little bit to the north, then the beam coming out of the dish moves a little bit to the south. Angle of incidence equals angle of reflection by an almost linear relationship. So all of the frequencies it operates at has one single focus. But if I've now got an array of antennas at approximately the focal point, and now I determine which of those antennas are lit up, I'm steering that beam. And by determining how many of the antennas are lit up, I can decide what is the primary pattern from the feed horn assembly, which determines how much area of the dish is lit up with a signal. That determines what is the beam width. So I can steer the beam in azimuth and elevation by the way I light up the parabolic dish. I can steer the beam in polarization. I can steer the beam in beam width. I can put a narrow beam on New York City and a broad beam on Europe, so to speak, by properly lighting up those individual elements. I wonder what you see what I'm saying here. That's a potent antenna if they're doing all that I think they're doing from your description, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, just like Arecibo, bro. I mean, it looks parabolic, but it's not. It might be that type of design, you know. Although Arecibo down in Puerto Rico, there's 1,000-foot dishes pointing always in one direction. Electronically, they can move it around. My guess is that's probably what they're doing here. So it's probably not parabolic. You know, I just call it all these dishes. You know, that's what I call all the dishes. But it might not be. It might be like a flatter surface with all these dipoles in front of it. It's definitely a mesh. They call it a mesh. I don't know. I'll research a little bit more, maybe. maybe on some of the future flights they'll have more about it. This is the first one.
This is ZEA.
ZEA, I think it is. Give us your full call and name, and then go ahead with your comment, sir.
My name is Glenn, November 2, Zed Echo Alpha, and I want to get on the list for questions.
Glenn, you're signing in at the tail end of the TechNet. There's a chance we won't get to you today because there were two people ahead of you. So it's not your fault, but if you really want to be part of the list, you've got to sign in at 8 o'clock. I think you see where you're going here. We'll try to get to you, but there's no guarantee. Back to you for a comment on that, Glenn.
Thank you. I'll wait my turn. It's a quick question. M2Z Echo Alpha.
Yeah, they all say that. When K2LIW talks, there are no quick answers. I'm verbose. Some people like that. Some people don't. By deciding, first of all, the dish can be parabolic. It doesn't have to be a spherical. The Arecibo dish, Paul, is a spherical dish. But the good news about the spherical dish is that it's an easier mechanical thing for them to set up. Unfortunately, to get full performance out of that, it needs not a point source feed, but a line source feed. It's a very elaborate movable feed horn in front of that dish, which can steer the beam plus or minus 15 degrees by moving that horn. I guarantee they're not doing that with this MUOL satellite that you're talking about, MUOS, I think you called it. It is closer to a parabolic dish, but it's a cluster feed. It's a phased array focal point type feed is my prediction, where they can now control AS and L and beam width at the various frequencies electronically. And so I presume the Navy personnel using this dish in communication have the ability to use a cell phone-like or a handy-talkie-like transceiver and be able to talk through the satellite. Did you have any hints, Paul, that a handy-talkie-like device might be able to talk through the satellite? I think it could. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah. By the way, MUOS is Mobile User Objective System. They even say that this replaces, what we would use as cell phones, because they don't have that in the middle of the jungle, wherever they might be. And although it's put up by the Navy, the military's going to be using this. And they said, most cases you could use the 1 watt, but in a tough situation, you might use a 7 watt piece of equipment. And they're going to run voice, so that's their idea, cell phone, data, and video. So all kinds of, you name it, they'll send it through this thing.
And because the beam out of that satellite can be so nicely steered electronically, if you and I were conducting a Navy operation in South America, for instance, you could steer the beam toward the center of that area in South America to emphasize that particular operation. That sounds like a very valuable satellite that replaces a whole lot of other hardware. One other subject I want to talk about, and that is the neutrino situation. There have been two or three separate reports over the last few months where various individuals, pretty smart individuals, were fairly sure that the timing was inaccurate because a global positioning satellite receiver was used for setting up the clocks, and that's subject to error. The global positioning satellite receiver was used to measure the exact location of the place in Switzerland where the signal was coming from versus the place in Italy where it was arriving. They thought there was an error there. And if you read the original full report that was published in end of December, beginning of January, from CERN itself, if you go to the right CERN report, very elaborate report, where they describe exactly what they did. For instance, one of the things they did was to take an extremely accurate cesium beam clock, set it up correctly in Switzerland, drove that clock overland to Italy, and checked on the clock in Italy, measured it to the nearest nanosecond in its accuracy and timing accuracy, then transported that clock back to Switzerland to make sure nothing had shifted in the meantime. But when the clocks are being set that way, that bypasses the GPS system. They had two or three techniques for locating the exact location of the starting site and the ending site. So the locations are probably accurate to the nearest fraction of a foot. That's not the problem. Now we're going to say that this broadband high data rate cable, which probably has quite a few hundred megacycles of instantaneous bandwidth, if not a couple of gigahertz of bandwidth, that something is wrong with its connector that created 60 nanoseconds of additional delay or lack of delay. Very unlikely. I don't believe it. To take a broadband communication system, which is capable of sub-nanosecond timing accuracy, and suddenly create a erroneous connector that throughout all of these experiments that took place with the broadband signals that were done in the early portion of 2011 and the narrowband pulse signals, the narrow pulse signals that we're doing later, and for all of that to have 60 nanoseconds of error in the connector of the cable, I don't believe it. On top of that, Fermilab also had a neutrino experiment that showed an extremely similar timing error. So are we going to believe that Fermilab also was using the exact same cable with the exact same error and made the exact same percentage of delay? You can see where I'm going here. It's not impossible, but I'm skeptical. The fact that they found a potential source of error is good to report. Somebody's being super honest, and the experiment's going to be repeated. My prediction is the experiment is probably going to show the exact same data. I'm having trouble believing this cable was doing it. You see where I'm going on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Oh, I hope you're right. I want to see some excitement in the physics world. No question about it. I mean, that would be big news if they retest. They did say they're looking to retest. They got to get this thing going. I think they got to restart this in March. And Fermilab, one of their big measure is shut down, the one that they were using. So I was reading an article about what they found with the, where they're trying to find the Higgs boson particle. And they were trying to find it before CERN. They did say that they are now shut down. But going back in their old data from a couple of years ago, looks like they found something that might help them in pinning down where to really look for the Higgs boson particle. And let me drive it. And hopefully they, with that information, maybe when the Large Hadron Collider comes back online, they'll have a better idea of where to look for this thing. And that would be fake news, because they're looking for supersymmetry and all of this. If they can find that, they might be able to, within a couple of years, come out with the statement that they found this particle. Well, they didn't find the particle. That's what they're really looking for, the God particle. And from what I read, the physics people don't like to hear that word. Back to you, Nick.
Question for Paul. John recognized, as you probably know, a fair amount of evidence has been gathered that appears to say that the Higgs boson has probably been detected, but is it a 5-sigma accuracy detection? Do they have that much confidence factor? Not yet, but it's looking good that they have pinned down the area where the Higgs boson probably is located. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Got a little assignment for Paul if he wants to take it. I'd like him to look on NASA, the site he visits a lot, see if there's anything written about the binary star system that we may be part of and the brown sun we were speaking about. If he gets a chance, maybe he could Google or look around for that. I've been trying. I haven't had much luck to find any more information on it. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, John, you told me about this brown star, which supposedly is the binary companion to our sun, and that it has, I think you said, an orbital period of once per 36,000 years, and because it is a brown star, I think it has not been yet seen visually, even though we can see the wobble of our sun and therefore detect it, and maybe even the data out of the, I can't think of the name of the darn thing now, the anisotropy probe, the Wilkinson. The Wilkinson anisotropy probe, I think, did find a kind of evidence that the solar system that we're part of is moving in a particular direction, and is the wobble of our sun created by this brown star. Could that be doing it? I know also that there has been evidence that our sun is part of a local arm of the Milky Way galaxy, and that we're bobbing up and down vertically inside of that particular arm, going above and below the mass center of that arm, if you know what I mean. And is the brown star part of it? You believe that that was on a Scientific American website. I went to the Scientific American website trying to find information about the brown star or the companion of our sun, and I wasn't able to find anything. So maybe you didn't first find it in Scientific American, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, that was, I wasn't sure. I tried to go back and find that article, and I get so many of these darn science tweets that come in. It came from a reputable place, but I just haven't been able to relocate it because I wanted to see if there were any links to more information, because that's very interesting. And you're right about the sun taking that undulating path through the our field, that arm that we're in our galaxy. And that's another reason we're drifting through a major collection of stars, then we go down through the middle where it's not, it's very thin, rarefied amount of stars, then we go lower again. And it seems to be following like what you would call a sine wave through that arm as we're rotating about. So, yeah, a lot of interesting stuff going on there. Back to you, Dick.
And as we go through the various places of that arm, which are more and less dense, do we have more and less bombardment by other space objects, near-Earth asteroids and comets and whatever? And has that created the five cycles of extinction that have occurred on the Earth? You can do all kinds of fancy speculation on that. Okay, let's go over to Wes's question. I wonder if we should do any further discussion of transmission lines. Transmission lines are something that's kind of complicated. Lots and lots of people have an awful lot of trouble understanding transmission lines. On top of that, this very nice article you've shown to us today as a, I think it's a YouTube video of a cosmic ray experiment where you see the actual flashing taking place in a kind of a cloud chamber. I wonder what is unique about that particular YouTube video, Wes, because I've only seen the first one-third of it so far. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Yeah, I'm going to have a few questions about your transmission line, but since we are in here, well, a number of scientific articles point exactly in the cosmic rate. So when we deal with a large time jitter that originates from the stochastic process that caused the actual breakdown of the spark gap, when an electric field is applied over the gap, at some point in time, a free electron will be created due to the cosmic background radiation. So then this free electron is accelerated to applied to the electric field and gains energy and then eventually hits an atom. When the energy of is accelerated, of the accelerated electron is high enough, this atom will be ionized and another free electron will be created. So these two electrons will be accelerated again. Additional ionization will take place. So at this way, the electron avalanche is created. Finally, via the avalanche and the additional process of the streamer formation, conducting arc, the channel will be formed, spanning the complete gap between the electrodes. And then the streamer is narrow, filamentary plasma driven by highly non-linear space charge waves. And then we have the breakdown process in, which is the stochastic process, the creation of the first free electron is stochastic, and also the electro avalanche formation has a stochastic nature, causing the large shot. Why I brought this to your attention? Because there is another paper, and why how does that has something to do with the cosmic rate? because there is another scientific paper that is a very much concerned about